Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, if you've not listened to the previous podcast, podcast episode number 78, I reviewed a book called The Invisible Man, and I did it with my friend from SFF Audio, Jesse. Say hi, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse. Hey, Luke.
Hey, and so I'm just saying that if you've not listened to that, because I'm putting them both in the feed at the same time, and sometimes people's iTunes or RSS reader only downloads the latest episode. So I'm just warning you, if you've not listened to our podcast about The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells, this one probably won't make a whole lot of sense, because we're going to talk about another book featuring an invisible man. So let's just get straight into it, shall we?
Sure.
Why don't you, Jesse, why don't you explain why we're going to just review this other book now, or
sure,
why you have to read it? You just go
sure.
For it.
Well, we were talking about The Invisible Man, and I was explaining to you, after we decided both to read it, I was explaining to you there was another book I had that I thought I would send your way. It's by one of my favorite authors, Donald E. Westlake, and the book is called Smoke. Smoke refers to two things in the story. One is the fact that it's got an invisible man in it who is like smoke. He you know, slips through your fingers.
Yes.
The burglar.
Yeah.
His name's Freddy, Urban Noon, Freddy Noon. He's a kind of a curious sort of half criminal. He's completely a criminal burglar.
I'd say he's completely a criminal. Yeah.
But he's not a psychopathic or sociopathic criminal. He's just a, you know, it's just his job. And
it's a guy. He gets put in prison. He comes out and he's like, well, I'm gonna go back and go back to.
It's all he knows.
Yeah, of course. But I'm just saying, why was it that you? I can't even remember the reason. You just said to me, I can remember you said something like, "Hey, this is a story of an invisible man done right," or something. No, what were the
yeah,
words that you said?
It's another.
To...
Yeah, basically, I was saying that the invisible man, the story's been done
yes,
many, many times.
Yes,
dozens of movies. There's a movie called movie and a book called Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Apparently, the book is excellent, and the movie's not so great. But there is I think there's not really a lot more that can be said about invisibility in fiction. It's sort of been said. We've got the fantasy end covered by Lord of the Rings, and we've got the science fiction end covered by The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells. However, I think there's still room, or there was still room until Donald Westlake wrote Smoke. Smoke is a crime novel, not a science fiction novel, not a fantasy novel. It's a crime novel, and it's a crime comedy. Now, as a crime novel, it wouldn't work. Invisibility is not a good use, because then you have to explain how someone's invisible.
Yeah,
because that's not a normal thing to find in a novel, right?
A
crime novel. However, in this case, it's a crime comedy. It's a humorous story told about a burglar who's invisible. Now, all the good things that come with being a burglar and invisibility are in the story, right?
He's
able to slip into any place and steal things. However, all the comic results of that are in evidence, too. So, for example, it's very easy to slip into a bank and steal
and
get a big
money.
Pile of money.
Yeah.
But then you end up seeing a pile of money walking out the front door. This is not normal, right? So it's got inherent comedy in it. And I think that that's why I wanted you to have a read of Smoke by Donald Westlake.
So why don't you just tell us a little bit about Donald Westlake and... because I read this book. To be honest, I didn't finish this book. I was a bit busy as well, but also it didn't really grab me in the way that I need a novel to do, or like a novel to do. But the writing is really good. Like you say, it is a comedy, and the writing, it's like almost a continuous stand-up, like observational stand-up comedy routine about life in New York.
Yeah.
I thought.
I agree. I'll tell you about Westlake first. Donald Westlake died 2009, January 1st, 2009. And he had written, about 60 books, 60 novels.
Yeah.
Most of them under his real name, many others under Richard Stark, his pseudonym for hard-boiled crime novels, very stripped-down novels. This is kind of the opposite of that. It's not. It's a crime novel, but it's a humorous one, and it has a lot of. Like you were saying, I really love the way he writes. I'm not sure he's the greatest plotter ever. I don't think he starts any novel with a plot in mind. He starts the novel with a premise in mind and develops characters. And then once those characters are in play, what he'll do is sort of let the plot work itself out. And so what often happens is you've got a good novel, then you've got a bad novel. You've got a good novel and a bad novel. And what I mean by a bad novel is it didn't work out all that well because the initial setup wasn't that great, right?
Yeah.
Now, in this case, I think it's sort of in between. It's a bit long. It's 12 hours, the audiobook version, and it's maybe four times as long as or three times as long as The Invisible Man.
That, I think, is probably one of the main things that I had wrong with it. Now, I'm not just saying, like, I was really enjoying the writing, but I got a third of the way into it, and the story hadn't started yet.
It's a little slow.
It was a little slow, even though, like I say, each individual incident and all the writing and the characters were all right. You know, I could understand what was going on and enjoyed what was going on in a way, but it was, it didn't really... The story just didn't click. Something happened. You know, they made what was his name, Freddy. They made Freddy invisible at the beginning of the book, but then it was just sort of like and now things will happen. Now, you were saying before on your own podcast, and we chatted about it on Skype as well. How all of his writing, it all starts. Actually, you just sent me a link on Skype. Let me open this up. You sent me a link. It was 5 things to learn from the writing of Donald Westlake. Now, I can't find the link here, but I'm sure I could bring it up here.
Send it to you again.
I clicked on it. No, it goes, choose strong titles. That's good. It goes, waste no time in getting to the story. And it goes, in the earlier books, the first sentence always started with when. Sort of like, when
this is the Richard Stark novels, but
yeah,
yes.
But also, it's it's like when the woman screamed, Parker awoke and rolled off the bed, you know. And I really like the example that you had in your your podcast a few episodes ago when you were like,
when the phone rang, Parker was in the garage killing a man.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's just a great first line for a novel. It was really, really good. And it goes in this point number 2 of this thing that you sent, 5 writing lessons learned from Donald Westlake. It goes, these aren't books that begin with long ruminations about the weather. There's action on the very first page. And that's true. There was action on the very first page, but then there wasn't action again. Things were happening, but it was more like, I wonder what a robber would do in this situation. Okay, now this criminal is going to go into this situation, and how would it happen there? And now he's going to go here, and what would it do there? And now he's got to sell his goods. Now, if he's invisible... and he's stolen something, he needs to sell it to someone.
Yeah,
now,
he has to take it to the fence, but if he goes to the fence invisible, the fence is going to want an explanation, and then he might have some leverage over...
That was pretty good, but and I was like, okay, I can understand the situation. And this is what, bringing it back to invisibility again, it's difficult to bring something new into invisibility, yet having someone who's already a criminal and is already, in this world, in this underworld, and then becoming invisible and trying to work out, that was... interesting. Well, it was only, like I say, when I got a third of the way into it, where I found the story was picking up a bit more. But then, I hadn't read it for a few days, and then just haven't done any reading.
Well, you can still pick it up. Maybe I'll intrigue you.
Yeah, maybe I will. I mean, I'm sure it's good. But it's that kind of, it's that thing, and bringing in yet another podcast that I've been listening to is the Writing Excuses podcast, and they always say don't confuse or don't mix up stuff happening to plot. Just because stuff is happening, events are taking place, and there's chases and gunfights and robots punching each other, that doesn't actually equal plot.
No.
It's just stuff happening.
I was telling you about that movie, too, as well.
I don't think we need to get into that particular movie, but there are quite a few things where you go, they've got a great short story idea here. Now let's make it into a novel.
The novel's more saleable.
Yeah, you make more money from the novel, And that's why, again, when I was reading the novel from Cory Doctorow, Makers, and at one point one character says to the other, oh, it's just a long series of crisis for you, isn't it? You just go from one crisis to the next, and you're not doing anything with your life. And I'm like, that's what this novel is. They're just going from one crisis to the next crisis, and then this happens, and then there's a bad storm, and then this lawyer comes along, and then they go to Disney, and then they do this, and then they meet this person, and then they have really, really, really graphical sex, and then this happens. But nothing's actually happening. You know, there's nothing, there's no story being pushed forward or moved forward in any way.
And one of the things I was thinking about,
I was going to say, this book
when you were doing that review, when you were doing the review of Makers, I know that Cory Doctorow had a policy on his previous novel, Little Brother, that if you took any 30 minutes from the audiobook, you could remix it any way you wanted, up to 30 minutes long, and then release that any way you want. I was thinking somebody should do that for Makers. Take out the bits that are interesting, because you said there was a lot actually worthy in the novel, and that there was a lot of
I think the first section
there as well.
Like that first third, like part one, just read part one. It's a good short story. You know, I mean, I have no problems with part one. Just read it. But then part two and part three, and then the ending as well. Just cut out the ending. You know, I think it could have been mixed down or edited down to a pretty decent novel, but it was like that. And then this happens, and then this happens, and then they're in that situation, and then they're in this situation, and then they're in that situation. And then when you actually get to the end of the novel, you look back and go, well, what actually was the story there? And I'm not even sure if I can tell you what the story was. And that's bad I don't mind that in a novel when there's something else, there's lots of other stuff going on there. And that's why I didn't really mind in Little Brother a lot, because while the story was... you know, very limited, you know, but the other stuff that was going on there was actually quite interesting. You know, the talking about the technology and the encryption and the you know, the new networks that they're setting up and all these other kind of stuff. That was actually interesting to read. And also it had one viewpoint character, first person viewpoint character, who, while not that interesting, you could actually engage with. Whereas in Makers, you didn't have anything. But I'm saying that Smoke by Donald Westlake isn't that bad. It's just that it didn't grip me enough to continue. And I think if I did continue, I'd probably get more out of it. But I probably will finish it off someday. It'll stay on my iPhone, I know that. I'm not going to delete it without reading it. So I'll carry on with it, I know. Anyway, we talked a bit about this. This book, might as well go into it a little bit more detail here. It's set in New York, or the first part of it is set in New York, and the setup is different. You know, the how to become invisibility. Let's just talk a little bit about the science fiction element here, which I actually really quite liked the idea that he had there.
Yeah, it's clever, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the idea is that American Tobacco or American Cigarette Corporation,
Big Tobacco,
has to fund cancer research, but they can't research lung cancer because that's too controversial. It's like they're researching something that they say
there's a connection to every kind of cancer except for one kind of cancer, so they got to research that to look
like smoking causes all kinds of cancer except skin cancer. Like, smoking doesn't cause skin cancer, so let's pay for the research of cancer, but let's do it skin cancer. And they're trying to come up with something which would, what is it, they want to make the skin to make a body invisible to UV or to a certain single wavelength.
If you have no pigment at all, you have no if you're invisible, you can't get skin cancer.
That isn't what they're going for. They're trying to look for a certain, it's like a certain wavelength or something that they're trying to make someone invisible at. So it's the bad bit of the sunlight which doesn't get it. It's something like that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And they have two ways of delivering the drug, or two slightly different formulations of the drug. One is an injection and one you eat.
It's a wafer, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a wafer, some biscuit or something with it in. And you can see it coming a mile away, you know.
Yeah, you
like,
can.
Oh, yeah. It's like, okay, well, we'll give him the injection. No, we won't give him the injection. We'll give him the biscuit. No, we won't give him like that. And you can just see it's like, okay, no matter what happens, he's going to end up with both of these formulations, and they're going to work together in a different way, in a way that they haven't...
So there's a pair of scientists living together in above their lab in New York City, and one night while they're upstairs having dinner, I think
They haven't had dinner. They're just about.
They're
to
just
have
about
dinner.
To have dinner. Yeah, and they hear a silent alarm from down below in their laboratory. They run downstairs to find a burglar in their lab, and he's about to carry off a computer monitor or a television. I can't remember which it is. and they pull a gun on him and say, "This is perfect, right? This is perfect. We've been looking for a test subject for human trials on this drug. And we can't go through all the paperwork that it would be involved because of all the human rights things." So yeah. They say, "We'll make you a deal, burglar. If you take this drug and let us monitor you for 24 hours, we will let you go. No charges."
Yep.
And, of course, the burglar is caught red-handed, as it were. He agrees on the spot. Unfortunately, when everyone's off to bed, he's locked in the room down below waiting for the drug to take effect. He, of course, being a burglar, manages to escape out of the room and taking with him what he thinks is the antidote, which is, in fact, just another dose of a different kind of
formulation, isn't it? Yeah.
Right.
No, he steals the... He steals the receptionist's computer because later on someone comes in and the receptionist doesn't know how to use the new computer. So that's what he's stolen.
Yep.
Quite funny. Yeah, so that's the setup. And then, of course, you follow Freddy, the burglar, the robber, and around. Yeah, and it was quite good, actually. Like you say, it's how to get in and out of a bank. And that's what I enjoyed quite a bit. But again, it's like one of those, it's like a thought experiment. That's what this book, and that's what I liked about some of the sections, like the way it was written, which was, in a very good style. Like he talks about someone's got a disgusting kitchen. He's a complete slob. So
yes.
instead of describing the kitchen, he just says he went into the unspeakable kitchen and came out with a plate. And you don't need to even say anything more than the unspeakable kitchen to understand that that plate is going to be disgusting. And that kitchen is disgusting, you know, and the whole place is just dank and rotten. And he did everything. Like he wrapped up the entire speakable apartment with that by putting in that one word. And that's really, I mean, that's amazing writing. And it's very funny as well.
He is a masterful writer of sentences. I think that if you judge his books based on the plot, you're going to find him wanting in many cases.
Yeah.
However, if you just listen to the way he describes characters, and you look at how he constructs a vision in your head, you'll find that he is very masterful. So one that character you mentioned is the fence. And he has a disgusting apartment, he has a disgusting kitchen, he has disgusting teeth. And he has a disgusting mind. He's basically
You get that part of the story from his viewpoint.
So the reason this comes up is because Freddy is being invisible, can't sell any of his stolen goods. He needs a confederate. Luckily, his girlfriend Peg is willing and able. She goes.
It almost seems like her idea. A lot of the stuff that they're doing, it's like she's almost pushing it. It seems like that a bit.
A little bit.
Yeah.
She's not dumb. She's quite smart and maybe a little.
Yeah, she's definitely the smartest one in the novel of that I've read so far. Anyway,
going through that. Yeah, even the scientists are very socially inept.
And the scientist bosses and the policeman that gets involved as well. I'm looking at that. I'm thinking actually the girlfriend is who I have most in common with, which is really strange. But
yeah.
She is more the everyman.
She's very competent. She's very very competent. She goes to the fence and has to negotiate not only for the money in exchange for some diamonds, but also for trying to avoid getting raped and killed, maybe. Probably just raped by
this
horrible...
It's also very strange, that passage, because it's being described... there's this passage being described from the fence's point of view.
Yeah, so sort of like, sort of a God's eye view of his thinking.
Of his thinking. So you're not actually reading what's going on. You're reading about what he thinks is going on. It's like, oh, yeah, and I'll get a drink, and she'll stay for one drink. And then suddenly it goes, yes, she will stay for one drink. And then suddenly like, whoa, that kind of thing.
Yes. He has a very interesting way of telling a story, does Westlake. He puts a slant on everything, right? Everything is there's no omniscient narrator, telling the story from a completely neutral point of view. He has... an omniscient narrator who is very slanted towards whoever is the focus of the story at that point. Yeah. So when
unreliable narrator in that way.
Well, it's not so much that he's unreliable as that he's telling the truth, right?
I see what you mean.
When Peg goes to visit the fence, we see things through the eyes of the fence, but more along the lines of we understand things the way he understands things, and this is quite horrific when we're visiting him, and it's quite funny to see her reactions. She's very confident. Yeah. I mean, we know that Freddy's in the room, right?
Yeah.
But we're never told that.
And now this is the bit which I didn't really like. That's what I'm saying. It's too much of a... the writing, that's what I'm saying. The writing is good, and the way he portrays the character is good, and also, like you say, the viewpoint that he works is good. I think that too many of the situations are like, okay, invisibility. Now, let's think about this, and let's think about that, and let's think about... And I didn't actually find that very interesting. I mean, the situations could be interesting. It's like, okay, how do I steal something from a bank? And it's like, okay, I've got to get it out. So it has to be something small and valuable. Okay, let's steal diamonds because they're also glittering. And I liked it. I was like, I'll steal the glittering diamonds and I'll hold them up against a glittering dress of someone who's in the diamond shop. And when they walk out, it'll look like the diamonds are part of their dress. And that kind of stuff is... sort of interesting, but more on like an intellectual level, but not on a, like, okay, let's get on with the story kind of level.
Yeah, it's longer than it, you know, it's much longer than The Invisible Man, and it's not longer because it's just packed with more ideas. It's just the style of writing of the time. This book came out in 1996. Yeah. Novels are a certain length in 1996. They're certain
We're talking 100 years later, and we're going, okay, now a novel is 500 pages long. Yeah, no,
that's
not
right. And people want the people are buying longer novels. So I think that the comparison is good only if you take everything into context. I sound like an apologist for Westlake, and really I am.
No. Yeah. Because, well, I understand. I see
these problems with the novel as you point them out, and I accept them as flaws that are unavoidable. Unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I'm just, yeah. The thing is for me, it's strange for me to, like, review a book, but I did want to, talk a bit more about a different approach to invisibility, and also you wanted to talk about this book as well, and I do think it is good, and I am looking forward to, I will read the rest of it at some point, but I just want, is there anything else that we want to bring up, like, tying this novel back into the, into the Invisible Man or into other invisibility? Anything else you want to say about this, really, is all I'm trying to say.
I don't know.
Putting you on the spot there a bit, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's okay. Smoke is a novel, a modern novel that takes another version of the Invisible Man story, the root idea, and it does it in a novel new way that is not just endlessly repeating the ideas of basically
H.G. Wells. Yeah.
H.G. Wells. And I think that's kind of a special concept because most of the novels that are in existence out there are not really all that new in many ways. So when you find invisibility is not a huge meme, right?
No.
It's sort of a smaller one. But
it's so well known, though. That's
it
the
is
thing,
extremely so. Well known, and I don't think you can just sit down and say I'm going to write an invisibility story and ignore everything that was written before, because
it's like time travel, isn't it? It's like so many people have written so much about time travel, and there's like every single time travel story that you can think of has probably been done before,
or at least something very similar, right?
Very similar.
So but time travel is much more pervasive. I mean, travel is basically in every television show, science fiction, invisibility is rather rare.
Yes, but I'm saying is that the way what's taken us after the time machine was written, it's taken us 110 years or so, and we're approaching getting everything that we can out of time travel now. Whereas with invisibility, it didn't take that long. Or let me put it this way, it took a lot less fiction to be made or to be written.
And that comes back
to get the same amount out of it and to reduce it down to get everything that we can out of this. It's like for a long time you see these twin movies where it's sort of like the same actor plays one twin and then the other twin. It's like, okay, everything that's funny about this has now been done. It's very difficult now to come up with that. So that's why it's sort of tail off, you know, you go through some of these cycles. And I do think, like you say, it's like now with invisibility, it's like, okay, we're done with this.
Yeah,
it really is difficult.
You know, how many nails can you put in the coffin that's that small? And that is really...
Well, how many times can you flog a horse that's small and been
dead
that long?
Yeah, basically, after a certain point, we have to rely on the ignorance of the audience to enjoy it. And
well, that's what I think is probably one of the bad points now about The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells. If you already know it, I mean, if people coming into it now wouldn't get half as much out of it as people coming into it 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, because there isn't that now history and seeing the images of the invisible man and things like that. So it's a very strange thing. Like I say, I think Donald Westlake, with his novel here, he has got something. It's just, I don't think I'm into crime novels, which is very strange.
Well, I want you to try that the novel, The Man with a Getaway Face. This is the first, that was the first Richard Stark novel that I read. And Richard Stark's, unlike Westlake, Richard Stark's sentences are completely different and yet utterly absorbing. The plot is fast-paced, usually quite fast-paced. Novels are relatively short, maybe half the length of this, of Smoke.
Right. That's
and
a good thing.
It is a good thing. I think that one came out in 68 or 67, maybe 66, something like that. Very old, but it's basically it's a fast-paced crime novel. Now, the difference between a Westlake novel and a Stark novel is basically that Stark has a character who is utterly ruthless. That's Parker. Utterly ruthless, completely amoral, doesn't, you know, killing people is a bad idea only because it makes you show up on the radar of the police, right?
Yes.
Does not kill people if he doesn't have to because it's just useless for him, right?
Right.
It provides, unless it provides a tangible benefit, he doesn't do it. But on the other hand, he's he's a heister, so he works with other criminals, and of course, being a criminal, you're working with other criminals. Not everybody is as ethical as him in the sense that, you know, if you're working with somebody, you don't screw them over. And so much of these novels is, you know, him getting in bed with some sort of less than professional thieves, pulling off a heist and then having to deal with the fallout from that.
Right.
Now, in this case, The Man with a Getaway Face, it is a fallout from the first novel, which I think is probably the worst in the series, and it's the one that's been most adapted to film, most recently with the Mel Gibson movie Payback, which is not great.
That's terrible.
It's pretty terrible.
I remember that. You know, the worst thing about that was the soundtrack. That's all I remember from it. He goes in, and it's got this really, really bad sort of, like, you know...
It's supposed to be 70s, I guess.
Yeah, 70s, but it's got film. This, like... You know, this bass line that keeps going on. And every time he goes somewhere, it's like, you know, it's like a parody of 70s bass line.
Yeah, it's
river.
Done almost as a comedy, which it's nothing
terrible.
Like the book. Sorry, nothing like the series. I say start with this novel, and see how you like it.
Okay, well, I will do that. You did send it to me, so I will see about reading that one. I just wanted to bring up a few other Invisible Men.
Mm-hmm.
Talking of films and bad films, there was the Hollow Man. Did you ever see that film?
Yeah, I did. The first
with Kevin Bacon, and I just looked it up just before I came on, and that was actually something I remember coming about. It was a David Manning recommended it. Now, David Manning was a fictitious film critic, like I'm just reading a Wikipedia here, created by marketing executive working at Sony Corporation around July 2000 to give consistently good reviews for releases from Sony subsidiary Columbia Pictures, which I think is actually great that this is not just a bad film, it's actually so bad that they had to make up a film critic to give it a good review to put on the poster, because otherwise they didn't have anything to put on the poster.
I think it is a bad film. On the other hand, I don't think it's as bad as. A lot of that is because you've got this exact same problems as you have in the regular Invisible Man. He's got an unlikable character. A bunch of unlikable characters. It's not the special effects that are in error. It's very hard to empathize with an unlikable character in film.
That is what I wanted to talk about as well, to bring it back to this, is that, I read The Invisible Man before I read this, watched the film. And then when I watched the film, I was just like, wow, I didn't like it. And they sort of missed the me caring about The Invisible Man at the beginning. Like, and I think that's the good trick with the novel, H.G. Wells' Invisible Man, is that we get to know the Invisible Man, once he's already invisible, and then we find out how he did it. It was here by telling us right from the beginning, you've got to put the seeds of his bad character in there at the beginning, so you never like him.
Yeah.
I never liked him. And when he goes bad in the film, it's a very impressive film. Like, the special effects are amazing in it as well. I mean, they obviously spent a lot of money on this film. But then when he goes bad, I never cared about him. And when he died, I never cared about him. But then the other characters, I didn't really care about them either, because they sort of created this situation anyway. And I think that's it. It's like, it's really difficult to make a compelling story about someone about a condition which is intrinsically bad. Or evil,
yeah, I also think there's something to be. I want to talk about that. This is something I thought of that I probably should have mentioned in the previous podcast.
Hey, doesn't matter. But we're putting them out at the same time. It's okay. A couple.
Basically, there's a human difficulty, a human conceptual difficulty that we think that words have, because words have meaning to us, that they apply to the real world. The concept of invisibility is a human concept, right?
Yes.
It is not something that is found in the universe. It is not something that you can measure. It's something that is the absence of measurement, right?
Yes.
So you have things that are, for example, camouflaged, right? You've got an animal that's camouflaged, a zebra, for example.
Yes.
Or an object that can change its color, a cloaking device. These are all possibilities of explaining examples in the real world of, or possibly the real world, of invisibility. But the
Can I just pause you a second there? One of my favorite examples of making people invisible is from one of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, where it turns you continuously into different things which people just expect to see there. So if you're standing there, you're not invisible, but you look like a Coke machine. And if you stand somewhere else, you're not invisible, but you look like a telephone box.
Right.
And as you walk along, you turn into continuously more things which just should be there, which I think is a great little idea there. Anyway, carry on.
It is. It's a nice little branch off the invisibility meme or...
Yeah.
What have you. But because they have this word visible, right? We can add this prefix in to make it non-visible, right?
Right.
The problem is we can then apply that to other concepts. So in the same way, I'm saying there is sort of an idea of, you take a concept and you negate it, and that makes a new concept. And the problem with that is it makes us think that there are things that possibly exist in actuality that only exist in fiction or only can exist in fiction. So one of the people I was talking about with this concept of invisibility was from the Sonic Society, and Jack Ward. And I was talking to him about invisibility, and then I mentioned Superman, right?
Right.
Superman is an alien. That explains how he can fly.
Right.
And I thought, as a kid, I thought that makes perfect sense. Superman can fly. I also thought that he has a cape that allows him to fly. So when I was a little kid, I had a cape that had a big S on the back. I didn't fly, but I...
Because you weren't an alien.
I guess not. But, a combination of being an alien and having a cape means that you can fly.
Yeah.
Now... the problem with that is Superman is an unsupported body, right? How is he doesn't have a jet engine under his cape, right? He doesn't have magnetic repulsive boots, right?
Yep.
There's no explanation as to why Superman can do what he does. Jack Ward pointed out that, you know, in the comic books, they've tried to reconcile this, but, you know, he can manipulate masses or whatever. Whatever. All I'm saying is, if you look at the concept of Superman and say, a man flying, you will believe a man that can fly. I won't believe it if I'm thinking about it in the same way that I think about invisibility. And that
Yes. It's
just not possible. I mean, Westlake and even, I think, yeah, and also H.G. Wells, they did think about these issues. So, for example, when the Invisible Man is smoking, when Griffin is smoking in the Invisible Man, you can see the smoke go into his lungs and fill, you know, all his brachial tubes in his lungs and then, you know, come out again. When Freddy is eating, you can see the food digesting in his stomach, right? It hasn't.
Well, that's in both novels that happens. They have to hide their body for a while until the food digests and becomes part of them or something. I'm not
right.
Sure.
Yeah, it's fully ingested. The problem with that, of course, is not all of it will become digested, and some of it's going to end up colon. Right? I mean, he'd be.
I think the way that you should do it to become invisible, you can then only eat food which has been treated invisibly.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you will slowly become more visible as your matter is replaced by matter which hasn't been treated in the same way. If you understand that, because you renew the matter of your body. You know, it gets shed away as skin and dust and comes out in bits and pieces like that. So
in the movie, the Memoirs of an Invisible Man, he becomes invisible in a way that is not by, you know, taking something. He's been part of a physics experiment that went wrong, half destroyed a building, or seemingly destroyed a building. Everything's still there. It's just some of it's invisible, including the part that he was in. So his clothes are invisible. This solves a lot of the problem of, you know, having to go naked. By the way, this is one of the things I recommend Memories of an Invisible Man over Hollow Man, if only because they do the smart thing, which is make the character much more likable. You know, he's not an unlikable asshole. He's more of a just an everyman with a comedic streak, I guess. It works better that way, but it's still not a great movie. Apparently, the novel is excellent. Everybody says the novel is excellent, which I'm going to try and get
over. Right. Now, let me just think. There's the guy from... I'm just thinking now. It's trying to come up with the... Neil Morrissey is his name. And he was in... I think it was a BBC version of some kind of Invisible Man. And this, what happens is he was put in to be a... I think it was he had to become invisible or something. But he was also a pilot who had transported some radioactive material, so he had actually radioactivated him. That's probably probably the wrong way to say it. But while they were trying to make other people invisible, he was the only person that it worked on because he had irradiated himself and things like that. And again, he was like he's just a guy, an everyman guy, and a nice guy, and goes off. And then it's the way that they brought the story into it is that he was then being chased down. So it was all about him being a fugitive.
Yep.
Which I think is, you know, it's taking that part of the Invisible Man story rather than going the other way. I'm just trying to find it online.
By the way, Memoirs of an Invisible Man does the exact same thing. He's a fugitive. Same way. By the way, also in Smoke, later on... He becomes a fugitive, but... the thing also in Smoke, if you think about it, there should be an obvious solution to this missing invisible man. Just make another one, right?
Yeah, that's the thing I thought was strange about that, was that they always had a technology there to just
They
do it
try.
Again.
They try later on. Okay. It comes with comedic results, of course.
Yeah.
So.
Let me just look. I'm just typing line down to see if I can find the the Neil Morrissey invisible... Oh, it was called The Vanishing Man, I guess. Vanishing Man. Let me type that in now. 1996. So yeah, that's another take on it there, I guess. So yeah, anyway, I think we pretty much knocked this around quite a bit, the idea of invisibility. It's quite good to actually just take almost a concept and then talk about it like the same concept coming from different directions.
Indeed. And I think we're going to do more of that on SFF Audio as well. So in March, we've got the Yellow Peril coming up.
Yes, I want to talk to you about, not mention that. 1 second. I'm just going to get it off my bookshelf. Talking about books that I'm going to read soon or next. Let me just get it. 1 second.
While he's away, we'll talk. So, how have you been? You enjoying the podcast?
Nothing. No, I'm back again. No, I just went to get this. So, someone the other day recommended, I said, hey, Luke, have you read David Wingrove's Chung Kuo?
Yeah. I've heard of it. I've not read it, but I've heard of it.
Okay.
Wait, heard about it, yeah.
The Middle Kingdom, which is actually quite a chunky book already. I think there's five books in this series. Now, I've only ever read up to book 3 or 4 out of the 5. I think I started book 4 but didn't finish it, because it's one of those series I really enjoyed book 1. You know, there's scenes from it that I still really remember and things like that. And it's talking about in the future, China has taken over the entire world. Now, of course, when I first read that, I was like, oh, yeah, China taking over the world. And now I'm thinking, China. You know, it's that kind of thing. When was this written? I should look it up. So I think I'm going to read this book next. And what I'll do is, yeah, it's 1989, and it talks about how the world is now one. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry. The hissing of Skype suddenly changed. Yeah, so it's like the world is now one big city, and it's like this big cocoon. Well, not cocoon. It's this big plastic kind of thing. They've found this new kind of matter which they can make hollow and very light. They can stack hundreds of levels across, and they can completely
arcologies
cover.
Or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, something like that. But it's like maximum arcology. You know, it's taking it to a huge extent. And
well, I hope you bring this to the Yellow Peril table.
Yes, well, that's the thing. If I'm around and I'm for that, that's the reason why I'm reading it, because I think this is actually would be a good novel to bring
absolutely
in there. So that's probably going to be the next book that I read. I read it before, but I'll read it and then give my opinions about how the series continues and if it's worth just reading one book or if you should tackle the full 5-book series. But it becomes a bit meandering. But anyway, I'll talk about that more next podcast. What are you reading at the moment next? Ooh. Or what they say, we're going to do this more themed kind of things for the SFF Audio podcast.
So I'm listening to many things and I'm reading a few other things. The Insidious Dr. Fu Manchu is basically, I think, the primary text for the Yellow Peril. There's a whole
bunch.
The idea
is I'm gonna read that one, but not review it on my podcast, but just do it as part of your podcast. But this Chung Kuo one, I'm gonna do as
yes,
my
please.
Own podcast.
I'm looking forward to it. Chung Kuo.
Yeah,
been looking forward to it. It sounds really good. Yeah. But I'm not so much on the series. But if the first book is worthy, I'd like to follow.
Well, that's what I want to do. I can't remember which event or which things happen in the first book and which things happen in the second book. So I'm going to read it to see if it's worth just reading as a standalone novel or not. I'll give it a go.
The other one I'm considering reading again is some Judge D mysteries. Judge D is apparently a real character from Chinese history. He's like a Sherlock Holmes as a judge. He investigates if a crime happens, he investigates the crime, he sentences the criminal, he does everything, and he's got like assistants who are out there, you know, bringing in witnesses and stuff. So I'm going to try and track down one of those, see which I started somewhere in the middle with short stories, but I'm going to see if I can track down the original story. What else?
And that's for the Yellow Peril as well.
Yeah, I think so. Well, a little bit, not really.
Maybe
it's
tie
just
it in.
Chinese.
Yeah.
It's just Chinese. It's not perilous at all. But I'm reading Starship Trooper. Not Starship Troopers. Starship Mercen. Last in the Starship series by Mike Resnick. Which is basically I'm describing it as the best.
I know, you say Mike Resnick is one of the best, right?
You know what? He, in the same way that Westlake's a very good writer of crime novels. Mike Resnick's a great writer of sentences and plots and stuff, but he's so non-science fiction-y compared to most science. I mean, his stuff is very not about the science fiction. He doesn't really talk about technology changes at all.
Yep.
His big great book, I think, is called Kirin Yaga, which is set on another planet that is basically Kenya as controlled by the Kikuyu.
Yeah, yeah. I know you've told me about this many times before.
Yeah.
I don't know. I forgot we're talking on a podcast. Yeah. Oh, we should really wrap this up.
Sure.
Okay. So, yeah, more Mike Resnick and more Yellow Peril-themed books in the future, I guess, is what we got.
Definitely.
Going on there. Anyway, so thanks a lot for listening, everyone. If you've enjoyed this, email me, luke@juggler.net, and maybe we'll do some more SFF audio crossover SFBRP episodes in the future. What do you think?
Good. I'm up for it.
Yeah, if we ever read the same book again, we'll do that. I think probably more on the SFF audio side of things rather than on this podcast, because, you know, I'm off doing other stuff all the time.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you can catch Jesse over at sffaudio.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can check out his reviews of audiobooks and his all the news, everything that you need to know about science fiction fantasy audio is on
there. We've got a podcast as well.
Yeah,
not as great as SFBRP, but it's pretty damn
good. No, it's good. It's a different kind of thing. It's more conversational, which I actually really enjoy. Normally this podcast... Oh, yeah, if you've never listened to this podcast before, I should have said this at the beginning. This is not a normal podcast. Go and listen to any other one which doesn't have...
You did say it at the beginning.
Oh, did I? Anyway, so, otherwise you can catch my blog, lukeburge.com/blog, for all information. And as I said this actually last December, but there's this video that I'm putting out, which I'm really looking forward to, of me juggling all over the world. So maybe you'll see that around. I'll put that up on the blog there, too.
I'm going to put it on SFF Audio as soon as it's up as well.
Oh, you're going to do that, too?
Yep.
Yeah, that's good. Anyway, follow me on Twitter, which is I'm @LukeBurge at Twitter, or goodreads.com/LukeBurge to recommend books and to follow what I'm reading as I'm reading it. Otherwise, that's it for me. See you later,
Jesse.
And
for me, too. Bye.
Yeah, and I'll see you guys later. Okay,
good
that's
stuff.
Good. That one went longer than I was expecting, but it, again, became a more of a general discussion of science fiction. But that's good. I think we've... Like I say, we've beaten that one to death.
I really wanted to put the nail in invisibility. And I think
it's like I never need to read another book with an invisible
man. That's basically what I'm going for is, you know, knock off these concepts, put the definitive end to it, and then I can mark it off my list of things to worry about.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to do after. One thing I was going to mention.
What's that?
I got into The Invisible Man falling from... and Yellow Peril, actually, both, falling from reading Alan Moore's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the comic book.
Ah, right.
In the first book, I've just got the cover right here, it has Captain Nemo, mm-hmm. Griffin, the Invisible Man, Mina Harker from Dracula, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. No, Van Helsing. As well as, who's the British
adventurer? The Adventurer.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Quartermain.
Alan Quartermain, yes.
Yeah,
or Quatermain, not Quartermain. Quatermain.
Is it Quatermain? Ah, okay.
Like Quatermass, right?
Okay, well, I was just thinking of it from a movie that I saw of Alan Quartermain, which was obviously put out as an Indiana Jones knockoff, though Indiana
absolutely.
Jones was a knockoff of that. You know, it's one of those weird things that you... that was a great thing that people said about you know the National Treasure movies, which I've never seen
don't need to bring your mind to the game when you play that.
National Treasure with Nick Cage, yeah. And anyway, so National Treasure say, oh well, that was just a knockoff of of Indiana Jones. But then the latest Indiana Jones movie came out, and then they're like, it's about the same level as National Treasure 2.
someone I was reading, you know what? It was that thing I sent you on movie theories. One of them said about the last Indiana Jones movie. Here's my theory. Yeah, all happened in his head after the nuclear explosion, dying of radiation poisoning.
Yeah, so as he was stuck in the fridge, dying. Right. But it couldn't have happened because the stuff that happened before that was some of the worst stuff in the film.
And I don't think it got worse.
I never watched the rest of the film except the opening section. But if it gets worse than that, that's all I need to know.
I'll tell you. I'm arguing possibly the best television show ever made. Yeah. Young Indiana Jones Adventures. Young Indiana Jones.
I've actually seen a few of them. They're pretty good.
It's amazing, mostly because it's just doing something that no one has ever done on film before, as far as I can see. That is taking a period of time and throwing a fictional character into that period to explore the period. So it was originally designed as a tie-in to an educational program in the United States. Like,
oh, really?
High school.
Ah, now that makes sense now, because I've sort of seen one or two episodes of it, and that makes a lot of sense now.
Yeah, actually. And so it did terribly on television. It was one of the worst, you know, shows. It kept going despite the horrible ratings, right? But if you watch it from the beginning, it starts in about 1907, and it goes to, or maybe 1905, goes to 1923, I think, with some later, you know, clips from the 50s with Harrison Ford to try and bring the ratings up.
Right.
But the as it's been released on DVD, it's just amazing. It's full of history. So one time he goes to Russia, right? He meets all the Russians who are influential at the time. He goes to Paris, meets all the famous Paris painters. He goes to Chicago, becomes a jazz musician. We learn all about jazz and the blues, two separate shows. And it's a good story as well. The main character is kind of, the least important part of the show. You know, the Indiana Jones character. And he's really quite different from the movies as well. But I've watched it maybe three times in total when it was on the air, once again on VHS and then again on DVD. And it's just so well done in that I learned so much. I mean, he's got an
I found a box set, so probably I watched episode one or two or something like that. I don't know, but I don't know either. Anyway, that's a good thing to look out for, I guess.
So I'm going to, when I hit stop on this, the file will start making itself, hopefully. And then I'll drag and drop that to you via Skype.
Okay, that would be a good way to do it, actually. Then I'll edit this. I'll probably put it up tomorrow because I'm going to be a bit busy now because I'm going to go out in a few minutes. And also, I need some lunch. Well, dinner. Well, lunch, because I got up at about 3 o'clock.
And I will, if you let me know when it's done, I will make show notes from my website, and you can take whatever you want from that.
Oh, that'll be good. Yeah. I'll copy them across onto my blog once you've done that, because you make far better show notes than I do.
More detailed. I don't know if better, but much more.
Well, to be honest, I have a computer program that makes them for me. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What I do, let me just tell you a bit about my production. What I do is that I have, I normally record it in Audacity, and then, so it goes through, and it's like, do, recorded. And then I cut the last 3 seconds off, because normally I don't press stop immediately. I press, finish speaking, and then it takes me a while to click back through the Audacity. So I cut the beginning off. I cut the front of it off. And then I have, in Audacity, you can write processes. I think they're called chains or something like that. And I just go, apply chain to project. And it does all the stuff for me. It does all the things that I would normally do to a file to make it sound better.
Oh, you should get Scott to do that, too.
And then what I do is that for each episode that I do, there's this little formulaic text file. I'll just open one here, because I probably have, and I'll send it to you. So, like, for example, on the last episode, oh no, that's not that. Let me do it this way. This episode. So all I do is fill in the information, and there's like these 10 bits of information per episode, and I'll just show you exactly what it looks like here on Skype. So it looks like that, it goes episode. So what I do, I just fill in that information, and then I've written a Python script which takes that information and populates these different other the things. So then when I upload it onto my website, onto my hosting, and I'm doing the podcast feed, everything's already formatted there, you know, and all of the things where it says, read Luke's here, look it up on Wikipedia here, more information there, all of that kind of stuff. And it, so where it says rating, I just put 4.5 here on this little form. But then it spits out the Wikipedia page, well, not the Wikipedia, my sfbrp.com wiki, where I have more information there. It creates those pages straight off, and it creates the blog post straight off, and it even formats little links, because I normally put a link on the Wikipedia for the author or for the book. I'll like in the extra, like external link section, and it even fills out the external link section or like that. And it took me a few hours to write the program, you know, in Python, but it saves so much time. It means I don't have to do anything, you know, just the information is formatted immediately how I want it to be, and it just works. Which
that's
is,
what we should get Scott doing, because it sounds like it saves a lot of hassle, at least on the file end.
Someone, hello, are you there?
I'm here.
Someone on Skype yesterday said, hey, how was your website? And they said, well, you need to, you know, they're just pointing out about the website. And they said, oh, otherwise, apart from this one little bit, it looks good. And I was like, oh, thanks, I made it myself. And they said, is it WordPress? And I said, no. And the thing is, I do the same thing with my non-blog part of my website, is that I have a Python script that builds it all from me out of little text files, you know, and it's so backward, but it means that everything about it, I, you know, I control everything about it, and it just works, and everything's cool in that way, you know. And it's a I know a strange way to do, but learning Python, the Python programming language, just saves, like in the long run, just saves so much time. Not even in the long run, even in the short term, you know, it took me like three episodes worth of podcasting.
Well, the main difficulty for me is not actually any of the, it's just, you know, if you're going to listen through your own show, it takes, you know, if it was an hour show, it takes an hour, right?
Yeah. Oh, I never listen back through to my own show.
I'm basically typing constantly the whole way through, writing down what I said, or what was said, and then providing links to repeats and stuff.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't listen back to my own shows. Sometimes I do later, but generally I don't. It just goes out.
It works. And you don't have to.
The thing is, if there's something that happens that I know I need to edit out, I go back and take that chunk out. But that doesn't happen.
I don't think there's much that needs editing on
the. Oh no, I won't. I won't edit these. I'll cut them up into two different sections. And there was that time when I got disconnected, so you got to send me two files. Remember?
Right. Okay.
Just remember that.
You know what? I can probably send you the first one now.
Well, whatever. Set them off. And, okay. Set them. Otherwise, catch you later, because I've got to get stuff sorted. Been good chatting to you. Catch you later. Bye.
Bye.